We are talking today with Annie Coe. She is one of the co-authors of the new book, How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office, The Anti-Politics Unboring Guide to Power. Annie, thanks for sharing time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us, how did you get involved with this book?
Through the internet. honestly, it was just a friend of a friend who sent an email out that said, hey, there's this crazy league of pissed off voters, and they're creating this collection of success stories of how young people mobilized. And I thought, that's really cool. I'm in South Korea right now, and there's a great case example right here in Korea about how young people use the internet and, you know, cell phone technology to win a presidential election. So I said, sign me up. And here I am on tour.
And how did this book come about originally?
It's a great story. So one of the editors, William Upski Wimsatt, he wrote a couple of books and got sort of connected into a very wonderful youth kind of movement, cultural activism, things like that, and then got asked by Rock the Vote to do work for them. He did, as sort of as a talent scout looking for young activists across the country. Very cool job, loved it, still didn't vote. He was part of Rock the Vote, but didn't vote. But he was in San Francisco in 2002, and there was, you know, some local issues going on, and one of the local weeklies dramatized the election on its front page, on the front cover, where they sort of broke down, you know, how to vote, you know, their recommendations, endorsements, you know, this proposition is completely screwed up, no. And he said, that's really cool. And he realized, you know, here he is ostensibly working, or he'd stopped working for Rock the Vote, but he was now working with Rap the Vote. And so, you know, there's all these sort of get out the vote, you know, young people should vote organizations, but they're not talking about the issues. They're not offering sort of education or information about what's going on actually in politics. And so we're telling these, you know, 18-year-olds to go to the polls sort of without any information. They're going to be faced by an 8-page ballot where, you know, maybe they know who to vote for president and who they like, but beyond that, it's actually very disempowering. You know, it's like, I can't even vote. I'm screwing up. Why bother? I don't have the information. I can't make an informed decision. I'm not going to do it. And so he sent out an email being like, why don't we do these voter guides for young people? Young people create them. It's not like this, you know, imposed from above, but just organic voter guides, and see where that takes us. And kind of that conversation kept on snowballing, and more stories came out about how young people, sort of in the last several years, really in the last few, like 3 or 4 years, have won or swung elections all across the country. And so kind of this new groundswell in political action, really creative, interesting ways of doing electoral work. And so he said, wait a second, there's this, all this stuff going on. We got to get the stories out there. Let's do this book. So it just became, I mean, the project just grew and grew the more people he talked to.
All right, and it seems to be a compilation of all these success stories, like a couple dozen at least success stories.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, you know, mostly all across the country. My particular chapter is dealing with South Korea. But, yeah, it's from city council, sort of local ballot initiatives to, you know, U.S. Senate, U.S. Congress races. Very cool stuff.
So can you share with us some of these success stories, some of the examples that come to mind for you?
Yeah. One of the first stories, and I've become such a freak for this book, I reread it, and I'm like, oh, it's so great. In Selma, Alabama, during the civil rights era, there was a mayor named Joe Smitherman who called Martin Luther King, Martin Luther Coon. He ordered police to beat up protesters. Really just nasty, racist guy. Funny thing is, come 2000, he's still mayor of Selma, Alabama. And pretty much everyone's thinking, he has been there, he is there, he will forevermore be there. Just this very deep fear and resignation. Fear of going to the polls, just general, just complete disenfranchisement for the African-American residents. And, you know, it's 2000, and these young people are like, wait a second, this is really screwed up. We don't want to have a racist mayor. He's been there, and he doesn't have to be there, and we're going to get him out. And so this group called 21st Century Youth Leadership started sort of mobilizing around the 2000 election and did really, really cool things. I mean, they got sort of like top hip-hop artists to come down and record, you know, Joe Gotta Go ads for the local black radio station, which actually incidentally was firebombed. No one was charged. Their campaign van was also firebombed. I mean, this is 2000 and this stuff is still going on. This thing just totally charged me up. In the local high school, Selma High School, they had this thing called Super Birthday Tuesdays, where on the first Tuesday of every month, they would throw a birthday party for everyone who turned 18 that month, and, you know, music, cake, and register them to vote. And so it just became part of the culture. I mean, there was block parties, people, you know, like, created songs, cheerleading routines. I mean, it was really the creative nonviolence. You know, how MLK said, we talk about nonviolence, but the creativity aspect, I think, is often neglected. And so for, you know, these young folks, they had fun. They really made it part of just an exciting, very hopeful thing. And, you know, November 7th, 2000 was a very screwed up day in election history for America. But in Selma, Alabama, people were celebrating because they kicked out their mayor, which I just, like, it just brings shivers to me each time I think about it, because it was such a powerful, you know, people are so resigned, and here's these young people are like, no, we can actually get him out of office. Chicago is another really great story. So the Chicago political machine is sort of notoriously dirty. You've got Richard Daley in the 50s and his son, Richard M. Daley, now, which, you know, funny, that political dynasty, it sounds sort of vaguely familiar. And they've got this patronage machine, which basically everyone is afraid to vote their conscience or speak their conscience because they know that they owe their job. And if they speak out, they're going to get fired. And so, I mean, I think Chicago's two-thirds people of color, but they've managed to install kind of the stooges, so like people who have the same face, you know, shape or color of the skin as the people in the neighborhood, but they're not representing that neighborhood's interests. So there's this woman in the 35th Ward, you know, who was trying to ban street vendors, you know, selling corn on the cob. And as a Latino neighborhood, wanted to get rid of basketball courts, wanted to rezone. I mean, really just not thinking, I mean, incredibly rude and incredibly just selfish in terms of how she was working in politics. And so this young guy, you know, from the neighborhood, his brother had gotten gunned down by gang members. He joined, I think, the Boys and Girls Club when he was 18 and eventually became the executive director. He's like, I'm going to run for office. I'm going to run against her as alderman. And there was this moment where the first time he ran against her, he lost, but he won almost 40% of the vote, which is great. I mean, he had no money, no experience in politics. He got fired from his job. So, I mean, just like a clear example of just how dirty the machine politics is in Chicago. And then after that, he decided to run again, and at this point, he was executive director of a local YMCA. Talked to the board, talked to, you know, the staff, and everyone's like, no problem, we don't see a conflict of interest. A couple days after he announces his candidacy, mysteriously fired. So, I mean, just that's the kind of culture of repression, and yet he keeps on sort of shouldering on, and the fact that he's from the community, everyone is behind him. I mean, everyone knows him, trusts him, and they're so excited. And I think that's one of the things the stories in the book illustrate, is that on a local level, once you get someone that you actually believe in, like, that whole sort of politics is boring, dirty, the choice between a lesser of two evils falls away, and you actually can truly believe in your candidate in those issues. And so they had no money. They had they couldn't even afford to make signs. So there was, like, a governor campaign that had just finished. And so they took down the signs from that and reused the backs of that to make his posters, Ray Colon, and they just sort of, you know, stenciled it on. They didn't even have enough of those makeshift posters to put in people's houses, and so they had people just carrying around the neighborhood. I think he spent less than one-third of what his opponent did, and he still won. I mean, it was the community being like, we really trust him, and we're going to work for him, and we're going to volunteer in his campaign, and he's going to win. And it happened. And so I think just sort of those two stories for me illustrate how even in sort of the most dire political situation, these young folk have just mobilized. I mean, my generation is supposed to be apathetic, but we really aren't. You know, we have hope. And the day of the election in Chicago, there were these kind of thugs sort of out there to sort of intimidate voters. And these young kids were like, you know, screw it. And so they brought their car down. They put the Ray Colon makeshift signs on top, and they played merengue all day and just partied and handed out flyers. And they're like, we're not going to be intimidated. You know, this is our neighborhood. And so it's just, yeah, like having fun. Like, this is not some doom and gloom proposition, but it's like, here's this guy who we love. Like, we're going to get him into office because we love him, you know?
So the whole concept you mentioned, apathetic,
yeah,
is that something that's kind of been handed down by, let's say, corporate media?
For sure. I mean, I think if you look at sort of volunteerism among young people, like, that's totally strong. Like, I mean, me and my friends, we all are compulsive volunteers, like, not just like one-off projects, but, you know, sort of long-term community building things. But all we see in the media is, oh yeah, you don't care about anything, sort of. I mean, even the Gen X stuff, now that that's sort of faded from the media, it's still kind of, now young people are conservative, they just care about money, this and that. And I think, you know, honestly, it's just, we're scared of politics. I mean, on this level, it's like, it's something that's very esoteric and like hard to access, and it's never been broken down and made accessible, and it's never, I mean, and the way the media reports national politics, I mean, who would want to get involved in that? It's just the horse race, like, you know, there's no issues, there's no passion, it's just like trading cards or something. I mean, just the way that they describe it is so boring and just mind-numbing. And so, you know, when I look at my friends and they're like, oh god, I don't even care about politics, like, I understand that reaction to the way the media has covered national politics for as long as I've been alive, or at least able to watch TV, you know.
It seems that, in addition to young people, that everybody for a long time has been getting turned off of politics, you know.
Yes.
But do you think it's especially designed to discourage young people from getting involved? Do you think young people just are more sensitive to the problems of the system and choose in greater numbers not to get involved in that system?
I think it's just the feeling that the political system doesn't work, and the fact that, you know, we don't see young people in Congress, and you don't see people talking about those issues that are so key. I mean, obviously there's some senators or congresspeople on a national level who champion education and who do but there's so many other cases where you just see sort of corporate in the lap of big business. And so the more you see that, I think the more me and my friends have been like, it's just broken, why bother? That kind of like deep fear and resignation. And I think especially, you know, for people who are passionate, but they're not passionate about politics, you know, we've channeled our energy into other directions. I mean, I was just in Olympia last night, and I was talking to this young man. He's at one of the community colleges there, and they're doing this spring offensive. So it's like all this information about issues and just action and all these things. And he kind of admitted, sort of embarrassed, that they hadn't even considered incorporating electoral work. They didn't even have like a voter registration booth. It doesn't cross people's minds because it seems like it's just so not part of their just even mindset. It's just like, that's something that someone else does. I'm going to make change here in my community. I'm going to do good things here. But voting, like, what's the point? And yet, if we give up that tool, someone was asking, like, well, what do you see people who are that cynical, who are like, there's no point? And it's like, as long as you're paying taxes and your tax money is going to fund this kind of crap, you better be voting, because you better be telling the people there that, you know, you want your money to go in this way. If, you know, you're not paying taxes, if you're living in a hut off someplace, well, maybe you don't need to be voting. But, you know, everyone else I know is still part of the American society, and you know, it's kind of our fun way of being like, this is what's important to me. So.
And the examples in the book seem to point out that when young people do get engaged in voting, that they tend to be the swing votes that win these elections.
Definitely. I mean, I think in the 2000 election, there were 27 million 18 to 24-year-olds, and only about a third voted. So, I mean, that's 17 million or so. My math is sort of funny, but a lot of people who didn't vote who could have. And the percentages that states were swung by, I think 6 states were swung or won by 1% or less. 17 states were won by 6% or less. There's a great story about Albuquerque, New Mexico, where there's this very local issue. Some developers wanted to build a road over the Petroglyph National Monument. Beautiful national monument, also happens to be native sacred grounds. And folks are freaking out, protesting, no go. City council's in bed with the developers. So they decide, okay, we got to do a political action committee. We got to form a political consulting firm. I mean, they're like, we're going to do this by replacing you guys in office. We're going to get our people into office. Totally works. They replace 3 city council members, all this stuff. Over the course of this electoral work, they happened to turn out 2,000 unlikely voters for the November 2000 election. And the state was won by Gore by 366 votes. So it was just sort of working on this very local stuff. They just happened to swing the entire state for a presidential election. And so, I mean, just like the numbers are so tiny, you know, it's like that 366, like one of the other co-authors was joking that that's the size of like an intro class at, you know, the University of New Mexico, you know, like a lecture hall. Like, it's just the numbers are so tiny. So,
and I also gather that the stories that are in this book, none of them made the national media. And yet you would think that in a country that holds itself as the epitome of democracy, the shining torch of democracy to the rest of the world, that stories that are in this book, they would be wanting to hold up as shining examples of how our system, you know, renews itself with regularity and vigor.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, it's like, don't tell these stories because then people might actually think that they can have power. People might actually get hope. I'm hoping that we can get, you know, this book, or at least the stories contained in this book, to pretty much everyone in my generation, sort of, you know, in our 20s, because the phrase that comes to mind is the realm of the possible. It's like, you know, I couldn't even imagine doing anything like this until I had read these stories. And then suddenly, ding, 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 wow, all these people have done this, you know, and these really interesting, fun ways of accessing politics, I can do this too, you know. But until there's that role model or just that one example, it's hard to even imagine, and definitely, you know, very hard to start.
Right, because the current system is so oppressive in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's telling you that, you know, your vote is useless, and I mean, just everything that the media sort of feeds you, you're like, oh, I'm just going to lie here on my couch and consume.
That'll make me feel better. So, tell me about the story that you wrote for this book, because you were in South Korea when a lot of that happened.
I was actually there the year after, but got to talk to a lot of the folks who were involved in the presidential election. So, really incredible story. You know the whole red state, blue state divide in the U.S.? So you've got, you know, coastal sort of liberal, and then the sea of red in the middle. There's a similar kind of geographic political divide in South Korea, where the eastern part of the country has been pretty well economically developed. And so they ended up being sort of the stronghold for the Conservative Party. The western part was very neglected and sort of became the Progressive Party's stronghold, or at least the more liberal party. A huge massacre happened in 1980. You know, student protests, and I mean, it was really, really bloody. And so they're a very activist, very outspoken sort of side of the country. A fellow who was a liberal in the Liberal Party was running from the most conservative district in South Korea, kept on losing. His nickname was Ro the Fool. Like, you know, what are you doing? Like, why are, like, because everyone just sort of bases their politics on where they live. Some people do have integrity, but a lot of it's just, you know, politics of convenience. And so some young folks saw that, you know, here's this guy stubbornly running as who he is from this conservative district, and thought not just that he should win, but that they should run him for president, because they needed that kind of integrity and stubbornness at a national level. And started a website promoting him and his campaign, nosama.net, and, you know, did sort of media stunts, all this stuff. Got covered not by the mainstream media, but by a new internet news site called ohmynews.com, which was a play on, oh my god, a phrase that became really popular in South Korea because of a comedian. So little kids who don't speak any English be like, oh my god. Their idea was the citizen reporter. So there's a lot of stories that aren't being told, and they would, you know, if you wrote a story and got sort of promoted to the front page of the website, you get paid like 20, 30 bucks. I mean, not a whole lot, but just the idea was that what's going on in your community, what the issues that matter to you, the stories that you know that are happening on the ground, those are important too. And so, I mean, it's blown up. Like, I think 1 in 6 adults now reads this particular news website, but they covered his campaign. And because of sort of the combination of these two websites, he ended up getting the nomination from his party. I mean, he didn't even have the backing of his party originally. And then there was originally 3 candidates in the race, and one, the independent, had pulled out and endorsed Ro. last minute, 7 hours before the election, withdraws his endorsement. And the conservative papers are just so gleeful. They're like, he's going to go down, blah, 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 blah. Young people are just really bummed out. This is a candidate that sort of galvanized a whole generation. I mean, it's really the parallels between Roe and Dean in terms of the use of the internet and sort of tapping into a previously, not apathetic, but just really disillusioned, kind of wary generation are amazing. And so these, you know, young folks are like, oh, God, you know, that really sucks. And they're like, wait a second, if we actually all turn out and vote, we could still win this thing. And so, you know, the day of the election, people were IMing each other. They were on email. I mean, I think one website reported, like, you know, 600-700% increase in use that day because of the election. Even funnier is text messaging. So people were just on their cell phones text messaging their friends, like, go vote, go vote, go vote. And he ended up winning by 2.2% of the vote. And, you know, they can't quite pinpoint exactly what did it. But for sure, internet, young people, that sort of convergence of a new way of communication and this sort of new fervor definitely helped sweep it into office. And in sort of recognition of that, the first interview he gave as president wasn't to a newspaper, but it was to OhMyNews.com.
So that, like you said, has a lot of parallels to Howard Dean's campaign as well.
Yeah.
Using the internet, young people.
Yes.
And somewhat similar reactions in both countries where Roe, after he took power, I mean, the U.S., they were just shocked that he took power. And in Dean, we saw where the corporate media early on actually were kind of like floored by his popularity and seemed to be going along with things. And at some point, once Kerry, I guess, started picking up enough steam, they turned on him.
Yeah, they just took him down. And I think, you know, from the beginning and for Roe's campaign, the conservative media were probably never even slightly positively covering his campaign. But I think one of the things that sort of is a little different about Korea is that broadband penetration is the highest in Korea than of any country in the world. Like, I think probably now like 3/4 of households have DSL. And so I think the use of the internet is, it almost can replace TV media to some degree, especially for a certain generation of young folks. So, you know, no matter what the newspapers or the TV kind of were blaring or freaking out about, they could get an alternate source of news and chose to trust that or pay attention to that. So I think the corporate media, while very influential still in South Korea, kind of faced a formidable like alternative because the internet is so pervasive. I mean, it's just, I don't think I've seen like a more internet crazy entire culture yet. So,
as well as cell phones are very, everybody's got a cell phone in South Korea. I was there a year back, blew me away how many people had the latest cell phones. I mean, they put us here in the U.S. to shame.
And there's a phrase for like thumb family for the people who text message and they like blur speed. They're going so fast. And so, I mean, that's a people that communicate like that. And, you know, you can forward it to 50 of your friends. So in a second, no matter where you are, like on the subway, everything is all wired for it. So, you know, you don't have to be at your computer. You're still getting information from your friends constantly. And people, I mean, that's the thing is, like, we talk about young people not voting, but no one's reminding us to vote. Like, it's about our friends telling us, hey, look, this is really important. It's about this culture of voting. Like, this is something that we can do. And it's not, like, doom and gloom, but it's something that is actually can be effective. And so, you know, I think there have been a couple studies, and they say that the most effective way to increase voter turnout is talking to someone about voting. And when it's actually your peer or someone in your social network, that is even more effective. And so that can be using Friendster, like, oh, go vote, or calling up someone, or, you know, whatever is easy, text messaging, you know, 50 of your friends and being like, okay, I'll just pay the extra 10 cents per message or whatever.
So. Well, even in the advertising industry, they still recognize that word of mouth is the strongest type of advertising.
Yes, yes.
I think they average that a given individual has a close-knit group of about 200 people that they interact with on a regular basis. So if everybody goes out and tells their friends, you know, to do this or that.
It's just, I mean, the social networks, it's just, you know, you're not going to have every single person sort of following the election super closely, but if just one person in that social group does and sort of conveys that information to everyone else. Actually, one really cool thing is this voter guide that the League of Pissed Off Voters is really pushing, is that fear of sort of not voting right. You know, you're going and you're sort of overwhelmed by the number of ballot measures or candidates and you don't know who to vote for. Really just kind of disempowering. So this one young woman in New Orleans, she's like 23, a waitress. She ends up making a voter guide, spends like about a little over $100 of her own money, makes 3,000 copies and passes them out to her friends and just people on the street. And it's great. I mean, you think voter guide boring, but she just put herself into it. So it starts out, you know, "Dear New Orleans, this is my love letter to you. And like a good lover, I'm going to prove my love to you." And she, you know, talks about how she's researched the candidates. And she's like, you know, "These are the things I believe in, so people will know sort of where her values lie." And she just tells it like it is. Like, she's like, you know, "This guy you should vote for, he's probably a crook, but there's not much choice here." I mean, she doesn't, it's the unvarnished opinion of this one woman. And it's so cool. I mean, people saw folks taking it into the polling place. It created such a buzz because if a friend of mine is going to hand me this thing, say, like, you know, "I spent a couple of weeks researching it and these are my opinions," I'm going to be so much more likely to go vote. And I'm pretty darn likely to just vote the way that my friend said because I trust my friend. Even if we don't see 100% on the same things, at least they know where I'm coming from.
So this collection of inspiring stories in your book, How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office, where do people go from here after they've read all these inspiring stories? Because so many things we read and we get really hyped for a day or two, and then something happens and we
get distracted. And a couple things. I mean, the organization that sort of put this whole collection out is the League of Pissed Off Voters, and we're putting together a really cool political website called indyvoter.org. So that's indyvoter.org. And it's going to be like the political Evite, Friendster, I mean, all these sort of social networking tools, but specifically geared for politics and a way to kind of leverage your social networks in a way. I mean, I think a lot of people are kind of freaked out, like door knocking, things like that. That's kind of, it's a little bit scary, but telling your friends, like, "Hey, look, what's up? You know, I'm throwing this party. Come out. Like, I'm going to, you know, we're going to have some copies of the book," or, you know, maybe a co-author is going to be there. That's not so scary, you know? I mean, I live in a two-bedroom apartment and I threw a 250-person party. Like, if I can do that, I can be a political organizer. I mean, I've done arts all until, like, I got involved with the League, so it's not like I'm some kind of brilliant young political artist, like the press release actually says. I'm like, no, confession. If I can do it, you can do it too. So Indie Voter, one place to plug in. We've got League chapters starting all over the place, so, you know, people can arrange for book club readings, you know, different events. We're going to be doing a lot of work with, you know, sort of local groups, so, you know, Oregon, there's the Oregon Bus Project, which sort of gets a bunch of volunteers and puts them in a bus and has them do canvassing in sort of swing districts all over the state. And, you know, we'll be working with them. You know, in Washington State, we just got a West Coast organizer. So Hallie is going to be definitely talking to folks, you know, here about, you know, ways we can help with local politics and campaigns. The voter guides, I mean, that's a huge part of what people can do. I was in Portland a couple days ago, and these folks were like, "Wow, that's a really cool idea." I mean, you know, they're musicians. Like, they have a band and, you know, whatever. Like, totally, like, very smart, very passionate people, not super involved in politics. But they're like, you know, "We've got a screen printing setup. We could just create these sort of beautiful little voter guides for the folks in the music community and hand them out, and people would pay attention because it's someone that they know. It's that guy in the band that they saw last week." So, I mean, that's definitely one way. And then it's about, see, little less than 7 months until the November election. And so, you know, there's a lot of things we're doing if you're in a swing state. And then I'm from San Francisco, so that's kind of like the bluest of the blue. We're adopting Nevada, and we're going to be doing a lot of registration and work out in Nevada.
You got to make a lot of room there in the back room for having Nevada move in. Well, any last inspiring words you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I mean, honestly, this political campaign, this November election, a lot of analysts are predicting that it's going to be so close, it's actually going to be easier to swing a national campaign than it is to swing a municipal city election. And, you know, for those folks who think that they can't make a difference, we all know 200 people. We probably know 300 people. We probably know 400, 500. Once you sort of start going out in those ever-widening circles, or even if you don't personally know 537 people, the number of people which Florida was lost by, I'm sure if you include two other people in that, then you're going to know that many people. And that's all it's going to take to swing this election. I mean, the numbers are so tiny, and the work that you do locally has national ramifications. And so get excited about it. I mean, you know, I understand a lot of folks are not particularly excited about the candidates we've got out there on a national level, but run for office at a local level and create that basis so we can get the folks that we trust. And, you know, who do you trust more than yourself? Local is just a beautiful place to start, and it really can make the difference on a much larger campaign.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Mike.
We've just been talking with Annie Coe. She is one of the co-authors of How to Get Stupid White Men Out of Office, The Anti-Politics Unboring Guide to Power.